the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, more rationalisation in the wool industry and processing sector. We hear more about that. And yesterday, South Australia reported three mass bird mortality events involving more than 1,000 crested terns presumed to have died from H5N1 bird flu. But what might it mean for the poultry and egg industry and others that have chickens?
In terms of whether it's likely to move into our backyard poultry and our pet birds, we have always said we can do everything we can to try and stop the spread of disease into those populations. So wherever we possibly can, improving our biosecurity measures, and pet birds and backyard poultry are two of those populations that we can have some sort of control over.
We'll also look at the legality of floodplain harvesting licences and hear some of the issues there, because we're hearing that some experts are saying that the legislation and the regulations appear to be doomed following evidence given to budget estimates this week. We'll hear a bit more about that shortly on the program. But first, a bird flu. Yesterday, South Australia reported three mass bird mortality events involving more than 1,000 crested terns. It's the biggest event so far, presumed to have died from H5N1 bird flu. The deaths occurred on remote offshore islands, including Trowbridge Island off York Peninsula, with two small islands off Kangaroo Island, with another suspected case involving a little penguin from Kangaroo Island. Kangaroo Island Mayor Michael Pengelly says it's distressing news.
Got advised earlier this afternoon that they'd found 1,000 dead, mainly crested terns, out on the pages. We're having bird deaths around the island. It's developing into a catastrophic event, I'm afraid, and I'm not trying to be alarmist, but that's where it's going. And we understand what's happening to the birds, but these poor beggars haven't got a clue. They're healthy birds one day and then dying the next, and that distresses us as much as it did at events during the fires, for example, when we lost a lot of wildlife. So we're picking them up around the beaches or the parks. So I'm asking people to make sure they don't handle them, to report them, get them off the beaches as they arise. But we've got 520 kilometres of coastline on the island, much of it inaccessible. So there could be, you know, a lot of birds washing up along the shores around the island, which we won't know about. The crested terns are in huge numbers out there. When you're on the ferry travelling back and forth between the Cape and Penishore, you see them out there fishing, diving into water and whatnot. They're suffering alarming losses at the moment, particularly that. But I think the worry out there is the Australian sea lion colony, which is threatened nationwide, worldwide. They're out there. There's numbers of them out there, as well as fur seals. So we've just got to hope that this thing limits to the smallest number possible. But no, it's very, very upsetting.
Kangaroo Island Mayor Michael Pengelly. Now, South Australia's Deputy Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Francis Walters was asked about the inevitability of the H5 strain spreading further into poultry.
What we can say is that we had already known that there was infection present on those offshore islands through previous testing. So these mortalities in greater crested terns will not be considered new events under the new event-based reporting. However, we have taken samples from a number of other species where there were very, very low numbers, sort of singular numbers of deaths, such as the silver gull, from those islands to test to see if we've also got a little bit of localised spread into other species on those islands. In terms of whether it's likely to move into our backyard poultry and our pet birds, we have always said we can do everything we can to try and stop the spread of disease into those populations. So wherever we possibly can, improving our biosecurity measures, and pet birds and backyard poultry are two of those populations that we can have some sort of control over the spread if we can limit their interactions with wild birds as much as we possibly can. So that's why we want to do this webinar webinar to ensure that we can give the best information to those groups to prevent that spread risk as much as we possibly can.
Crested terns seem to be bearing the brunt at this stage of the flu. Do we have any idea why that species is perhaps more susceptible?
So I'm probably not the best person to answer that. An ecologist would be able to provide a lot more information on that particular species. And we get our advice and work really, really closely with the experts at the Department for Environment and Water to provide us with that advice accordingly. What they have said is that we know that this disease is new to Australia. We're the last continent on Earth to have got this disease, and therefore we don't know the exact impacts on our native species that it is going to have at this time. And obviously the greater crested tern is an example of one of those species that appears to be quite susceptible to the disease.
What should people be keeping in mind as the spread potentially continues?
So really the key message that we want to make sure people know is to avoid touching any sick or dead birds. Please do not pick them up. Please just avoid them. Record what you see, so just take note, or if it is safe to do so and you're not going to be disturbing any other birds, you can record it on your phone so we can see what you're seeing, and report it through to the Emergency Animal Disease Hotline on 1800 675 888.
As PIRRS's Deputy Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Frances Walters speaking to Isabella Kelly, the public's also being asked to report any sick or dead birds or wildlife bird deaths that you may see. And again, avoid touching those sick or dead birds and other wildlife. Record what you see and report it to the Emergency Disease Hotline on 1800 675 888.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, we're hearing that experts are saying that the legality of floodplain harvesting licences appear to be doomed following evidence given to budget estimates this week. Greens MP Kate Furman quizzed Minister Rose Jackson and Amanda Jones, the Deputy Secretary of Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, and also NRAR boss Grant Barnes about the suitability of floodplain harvesting licensing and laws, as the government has lost a number of high-profile court cases with irrigators over the enforcement. Some others are still waiting to go through the courts as well. Grant Barnes stopped short of saying that the laws and regulations were fatally flawed, but he did acknowledge in parliamentary estimates that the regulatory and legal framework was making it very hard for NRAR to pursue legal cases in various floodplain harvesting situations. Greens MP Kate Fairman asked him about the issue of floodplain harvesting.
Appreciate I won't get drawn into speaking about Mr. Harris for obvious reasons, but I can say that a recirculation dam is an excluded work under the regulation.
So when did you become aware that what seems to be honest, the vast majority of dams that store floodplain harvested water were classified as recirculation dams?
To be classified as a recirculation dam, it must be constructed and used to capture, contain, recirculated, contaminated water.
When did you become aware of this as NRAR?
Aware of what?
The fact that the major storages on these big cotton farms that hold the water are in fact recirculation dams, that our laws that are in place to regulate floodplain harvesting have somehow made them excluded.
When was I aware of that regulation for excluded works?
The whole mess.
It's not
a bit of a mess, isn't it?
I'm not going to...
I don't know how you do your job. I mean, because it's impossible to tell now. Like, it was at one point, like, something has happened here. Who made the decision, do you know, to reclassify the recirculation dams? Water Group or Water New South Wales? Or do you have any idea?
I have an idea that there's a rule maker in our environment, there's a rule implementer and there's a rule enforcer, and I'm the enforcer at the end of the chain.
Were you consulted on the classification of recirculation dams and what the regulatory implications would be?
NRAR certainly contributed through the board, advice on floodplain harvesting, measurement policies, the licensing regime itself and the regulation.
Can you successfully regulate floodplain harvesting take with recirculation dams and tail water drains and the way in which they're defined in terms of the water they can take, can you actually really successfully prosecute illegal floodplain harvesting take in this environment, regulatory environment?
We encounter some uncertainty as to the application of the law in regards to floodplain harvesting. So to put that simply, if at its outset we have to determine what the legal authority is. So is it work taken under a floodplain, is it water taken under a floodplain harvesting licensing or another water access license or under a basic landholder right or under an exemption? Is it rainfall exempt? Is it regulated tailwater? These are all primary considerations before you then go into the complexity of quantifying the take under those various components. This is why it does take some time to get
and
to a point.
And the reason it's so important, we've just got, the Menindee Lakes, for goodness sake, reaching that critical trigger, riverbeds starting to dry up, Walgett's not looking good. Meanwhile, we've got probably half of the, most of these big cotton irrigators have got a 500% carryover. It's very difficult to find out whether they're taking water, what they're taking, whether they're taking it over and above their licence. But that's correct, firstly, isn't it? Most of them would have a 500% carryover at this point.
I'll defer to the water group.
Would they, Ms Jones, just quickly?
It really depends. I'm happy to take your question on notice. It really depends on a specifics of a licence. But a carryover function is an accounting function.
The rainfall runoff makes up 40 for this NRC. Thank you again for your great work, Professor Hugh Durrant-White. Makes up 44% of floodplain harvesting, yet 61% of that's exempt. They're saying the rules for exemption are unclear and difficult to enforce. Rainfall runoff is likely to be available. Then goes on. This is a complete disaster in terms of floodplain harvesting regulation. All of these years to get this right, and then you've got the biggest storage on farms, pretty much the only big irrigation companies, pretty much all of the water. It's a rort, isn't it? Mr. Barnes, the regulator?
I'm not going to comment on it in that regard. What I do say is we remain committed to ensuring that the obligations of those licences are fully met and will enforce the law to the full extent we're able.
And to be clear, I'm not, when I'm doing this, not doubting your integrity as a regulator.
That's Kate Fairman talking in budget estimates to Grant Barnes from NRA there earlier this week. And in budget estimates this week, the Minister, Rose Jackson, reiterated that she did not subscribe to the view that the legislation was doomed or fatally flawed. And she says they're working through various legal opinions to sort out a remedy for any legal problems that may have arisen. I did, of course, a request an interview with the Minister, but they pointed me to her statements in budget estimates earlier this week, and we played some of those on the program yesterday. It's 18 minutes past 12.
Backpackers are essential to help harvest the fruits and vegetables Australians love. But as working holiday visas approvals slow, will there be enough workers? To find out more, listen to Country Breakfast on Radio National.
19 past 12. Well, the grains industry is facing a number of headwinds at the moment. The war in the Middle East, massive fuel and fertiliser prices, also the supply of that as well. And we're also facing an uncertain season in many parts of New South Wales. There's also a question mark over the chemical use of certain chemicals as well into the future. In this backdrop, the lobby group Grains Producers Australia has a new chairman, Moree farmer Matthew Madden, and I spoke to him about some of those challenges that he's facing in this new job.
All those concerns are actually still relevant because the situation, the geopolitical situation in the Middle East, hasn't actually been resolved yet. We know we've got some fertiliser that's coming to Australia underwritten, which has caused its own issues. The fuel appears to be, supply seems to be okay at the moment, but at the drop of a hat that could change. So some of the policy positions there are, do we need more fuel in Australia? Who's going to pay? And actually making sure it's here available in time-critical processes like harvest. and sowing. But the price, obviously. We're at the end of the food chain, so we pay. We need it, so we've got to pay for it. We're in a fortunate position that Australia's quite a wealthy country. We can actually afford it, but it doesn't help the farmers' margins.
That seems to be, you know, the talk from farmers that, you know, when it wasn't really raining at the right time, they were worried, can I make any money at the end of the year from this crop?
We farm east of Moree, and we had a very dry summer, one of the driest summers for a long time. So our subsoil moistures were very low going in. So do we buy $1,200 urea on low profiles? We did get a very good end of May rain into June, but 120 mil, so we were able to get our program going, but we're not guaranteed. We're still, things look reasonable, but one more fall of rain will get us over the line. But yes, it's the margins are the issue. With fertiliser, fuel, spare parts, machinery costs, we all recognise they're going up, but our actual margins aren't following them. Pricing looks okay from the outside, probably higher decile some of them, but they haven't actually gone up in line with our input costs.
Now, as a new president, what are the other major issues that you think you'll be dealing with, or members will be asking you to deal with?
On top of those ones, they're put biosecurity, and it's always the issue. The GRDC levies on all sides of the continent are looking at the reserves and wanting at least some resolution on direction of what we can do about that to ensure that the reserves just don't keep growing for any reason. So GRDC, we're working with GPA and GGL, we'll be working together to ensure that we get voices from as many levy payers as possible to get the outcome, to get a resolution to what can be done.
I mean, it's a situation where you've got like $1 billion just sitting there, not doing anything. Is that the concern? Like, you should be on research, or could be going back to growers? What's on the table with that money?
Well, that's the interesting thing about national representation. There are different opinions from different states. So we're trying to get those into one room to get a resolution on that. People are happy that we've done well, because that research and development has enabled us to grow more crops, but they're concerned about the growth of the reserves. And they don't really want just willy-nilly spending to, or dare I say it, sort of wasted. And GRDC had put in plans with some blue sky spending, but also I think some growers would like to see a better plan for the reserves. Can we stop them growing as much?
I mean, is it hard to argue with the federal government about getting more funding for things like R&D when there is that money sitting there? So the government's going, use your own money. We're not going to give you any more assistance for biosecurity or crop research.
Well, it becomes a matter of equity then, because all RDCs across all industries receive a certain percentage of the money that they raise. And we're no different. It's just that we raise more money. We don't want to see a drop in levy because of a drought, so that would be the worst thing that could happen. So, and we have to ensure that there is a really viable amount of money available for the 5-year and 10-year research projects. However, it's the growth in the reserves that's really bothering a lot of growers, and that's what we'll be trying to prosecute there. Is there a better method or better way to address that?
They're too conservative with the money? They're holding on to it too much?
They've got a fiduciary duty to ensure that those reserves are wisely spent. There's capacity issues, that just finding enough people to, as the reserves have grown, finding enough capable people to actually run the research properly. Otherwise, you might run into the problem of wasting it. Nobody wants to see that.
Is there a push to, you know, look at things like insulating farmers against things like climate change, where we need, you know, different varieties of canola or wheat that are more drought and heat tolerant?
I think that's always ongoing. If we drill down into some of the research projects GRDC run, they're already there in conjunction with the breeding companies that they've got a stake in with Dedicide. I think we've seen some of the results of that, and we're already pretty positive because our production's going up in the face of more variable and volatile climate conditions, but our actual production is going up. Our water use efficiency is improving. Maybe it's time to look at the quantum of the levy and also ensure, we just have to ensure that the money's spent wisely. And a levy percentage is probably a bit more flexible than it is now.
What about things like chemical use? We've heard about the paraquat issue. maybe more research needs to be done to allow that sort of continuous cropping, no-till cropping system, but we might need to look at other ways of doing it without so much chemical use, for example.
Absolutely, and again, that research is happening right now with new chemicals. I know there's still chemicals, but new chemicals that are coming on all the time, the work GPO and others are doing with the AVP major and chemical companies to ensure that there are new molecules coming through that may replace paraquat, maybe replace glyphosate, but also the farming systems work that's done, the big five, they call it Weed Smart, yeah, rotation and or looking at other methods. I mean, the latest one, a newer one now, is AI-controlled chipping machines. It's actually chemical-free, but it will just chip out weeds on their own. And that's been funded with GPA and other partners to ensure that there's some good outcomes for growers, not just relying on all chemicals, but looking at a wide spectrum of things that could actually help farmers retain profitability going forward.
And that would solve the issue for those farmers that feel that they might be at risk of disease or with some of the chemical use there, that would certainly be a fillip for them.
Most farmers prefer to use less chemical, but the system has evolved that is the better way. We wouldn't be in this fortunate position without the crop protection products we have now. But that doesn't mean we're going to rely on them forever. So innovation and research looks at the whole gamut of products that might, or systems that might help us into the future.
Matthew Madden is the new chair of Grain Producers Australia and he's a Moree farmer. It's 27 minutes past 12.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
David's text in on water licences and floodplain harvesting, saying the amount of lies and spin on water licences is nothing short of absurd, and he says that Rose Jackson should be sacked as the minister. There's a few other texts coming through as well on the water issue too. It's 27 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, how good is your chainsaw? Does it get the job done? Or do you wish it had a bit more power and a bit more guts to it? Was South Australian farmer and president of the Keith and Tintinara District Show Society, Glenn Simpson, decided to build a very special chainsaw recently, one with a V8 car engine. Elsie Adamo caught up with Glenn on his property to see this bit of equipment for herself, and she asked him what prompted this unusual project.
We're renowned for doing things a bit out of the box in Keith at the Keith Show Society, and or the Keith Show Revved Up, we call it now, because we blended the Keith Diesel and Dirt Derby with the Keith Show for one event a year. And we like sort of things that people don't do in other areas or other districts. So I saw on Facebook or YouTube or somewhere this, I don't know, I think it was in America somewhere, like V8 chainsaws. I thought, oh, that's great. So I Googled it, found a bloke in New South Wales to bring one across to the Keith Show. And he said it was too hard and couldn't come. And I thought, oh, I've started this now. I'm going to have to build one. So then the challenge began.
How difficult was it to build?
It was a bit tricky. Originally, I was going to build two, a Ford and a Holden one, so, you know, have a bit of a race. But it was a bigger job than I thought, so I was just stuck with the Holden one at this stage.
Like time-wise?
After work, weekends, and a bit of work time.
Don't tell anyone.
No, don't tell anyone. So, no, it was all good fun. But rounding up the parts and get a few niche parts made and stuff. So, yeah, it was good fun. Probably took 6 months to build it. So, like, obtaining engines and, you know, right-angle gearboxes and a bit of lathe work and, yeah.
Have people been surprised that you went to the effort to make this?
Yeah, they think I'm mad. But it's fine. It's fine. It's cool. It's good fun. Kids love it. Adults love it. People go, why? But, lots of noise, lots of fun. Yeah.
So explain a bit about what it is.
Yeah, it's obviously a chainsaw. So we've got a Holden V8. And obviously you don't run a radiator or anything like that. And we take all the gearbox off and put a right angle gearbox on it. And we got forestry harvesting machinery, like the blade, the bar and the chain and the sprocket, and adapted it to the V8 chainsaw. So we cut pine with it. Oh, we've cut a bit of harder wood, but and it's all a bit of fun and it's a lot of noise.
What are its uses, Glenn, that a normal chainsaw can't do? What can you do with this
one? Well, we did cut a few big logs at the Keith Show for the fire buckets, but obviously with no radiator, you can't cut for that long. It gets a bit hot, but cuts very quickly. And it's just, it's a bit of a piss take, you know. it's for shits and giggles, really, for laughs. And it's, and people go, why? Why not? Yeah. So, you know, we've got a couple of V12s in lawnmowers and stuff. So the next challenge might be a V12 chainsaw.
V8's not enough.
No, V8's not enough. So, no, we love it. It's just fun. And we had the other traditional hot saws at the show. Then we threw the V8 chainsaw in amongst that for laughs. And it was, yeah, great fun.
How's the interest in it been?
Oh, it's been huge. People love it. And people go, why, really? The kids love it. So, yeah, puts out a fair note. We made sure we had some nice extractors on it. And, yeah, for the V8 lovers, it's really great.
It seems to have a few limitations that a normal chainsaw doesn't.
Yes,
maybe
you can't
not
lift
quite
it.
As mobile.
Yeah, not quite as mobile. Yes, it's sort of like, yeah, hinged on it, on the wheels, obviously, because it weighs so much.
Yeah.
But some of them have two blokes that lift them, but we wanted to make it so that one person could operate it.
So what have you been using it for mostly?
Well, the workman told me off because when I first built it, every time I walked past it in the shed, I started it up. They said, you got to stop doing that. It was going to be worn out in no time. So, no, it's for fun, pure fun. If people come over on a Friday night or a Saturday, we start it up and cut a bit of wood for them.
Has anyone been asking to borrow it?
No, and I won't lend it either. Probably a bit dangerous too. Hey. Yeah, so it's just another little niche thing for our key show.
Just a little bit dangerous, the V8 engine chainsaw there. Not going to lend it out, and doesn't sound like it does too much with it. But anyway, it's a V8 chainsaw. There you go. That was Glenn Simpson from the Keith and Tintinara District Show Society. Adam Story, the V8 leaf blowers in your...
I think it's a goer.
It's a goer.
Oh, no, in my street,
need one,
mate,
at your place,
mate. You tap your tap your teaspoon on your cup, and you get a complaint from the neighbours.
You got too many trees in your street. You want to get onto those?
There is a few actually. Yeah. I might just leave them as where they are. They do look nice.
Fair enough.
I was just. What about the V8 leaf blower?
I know. That's right.
I'm thinking maybe a V8 creepy crawly, you know, clean your pool in minutes.
Yeah, that's it. Well, 1 minute and out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it'll clean the windows as well.
Oh, now that's what I need, mate, for someone who cleaned the windows last week and almost, you know.
Now you can't see out of them.
Strain numerous muscles doing it. Oh, no, they look jocking. I'm going to give it another go this weekend, actually.
Good luck. Good luck with that. Yeah. Stay safe.
Yeah, I really should just pay someone to come in and do it. Investigation is underway into a fourth incident on the runway at Sydney Airport in almost as many weeks. The Transport Safety Bureau says it was alerted to what's known as a taxiing conflict on Tuesday morning when a Qantas plane bound for Melbourne was given clearance to turn onto a taxiway that another Qantas plane was already on when the crew noticed the aircraft brake suddenly. The ATSB said there was no immediate risk of collision, but it is the fourth time. Planes have been given conflicting instructions from air traffic controllers, and that's amid a well-known shortage of them.
Mm.
The Sydney Swans captain Callum Mills and the team's coach Dean Cox have faced questions from the media this morning following the scandal that's engulfing the club. Callum Mills and Dean Cox have both supported the sanctions that have been imposed on the five players. They've, of course, apologised to all those involved. And at this stage, still no charges have been laid and no one has been formally interviewed. Catholic Schools New South Wales says its chief executive, Douglas McInerney, has been sacked days after he gave evidence at the state corruption inquiry into Liberal Party donations. He previously stood aside from the role while the probe investigated whether he arranged undeclared political donations through the organisation that exceeded the legal limits. And Origin Energy has announced that as many as 60 customers had their full bank account numbers accessed by a hacker in July. Last month, Origin confirmed a major cybersecurity breach affecting around 900,000 current and former customers. Origin has also confirmed the hacker accessed numbers associated with government concession schemes or programs of about 15,000 customers. And warnings today from the SES to prepare for a wild and windy storm season. September is the beginning of the high-risk part of the season. Emergency services say the El Niño climate pattern this year will increase the likelihood of dangerous storms and damaging winds.
So watch out.
Look out. Tie it down.
Okay. Yeah. And you'll be back at 1 o'clock.
That's for sure.
Okay. Thanks for that, Adam.
Okay.
It's coming up to 25 minutes to one. Time to get some weather details. Tristan Simonis at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. How's your Friday doing?
Oh, just great. And some good rain in the west of the state. Didn't realise, but they're up to 40 millimetres in some parts.
Yes, most definitely right. So we've just had a large rain band come through associated with the trough that's moving towards the east yesterday. And with that, we did see around 40 to 50 millimetres fall on the far northwestern corner of the state, particularly at Tibooburra and now Barona Downs as well as receiving some more significant moderate rainfall. But elsewhere across the upper central west, we have been seeing around 5 to 15 millimetres or so fall with this cloud band as it starts to move further towards the east, towards the northwest slopes and plains and the New England region later today.
So what sort of rain can they expect at sort of Tamworth, Moree, Narrabri? You know, are they going to get that 40 millimetres or not as much?
Look, as this trough is moving east, we are expecting it to start decreasing in strength, and with that, the frequency of rain and showers is also expected to be on a easing trend as well. So for the northwestern slopes and plains region, we are expecting widespread around a couple millimetres here or there, nothing really above the 10 millimetre mark. Of course, if you are underneath a shower, you could be receiving around 10 millimetres or so, particularly near Moree. But there isn't too much expected with this system as it is currently on a weakening trend as it heads towards the northeast.
Right, so they're expecting less. Not a big dump of rain there, although they wouldn't mind a bit of rain in that part of the world, I gather. Pretty dry. What's happening next? Is there another system coming through?
Yes, so after a dry and stable, relatively stable weekend, we are expecting another system to cross New South Wales, starting from around late Monday or so in the west, and then eventually spreading and extending towards much of the state during the Tuesday, and then contracting to the eastern half of the state on the Wednesday. So you can expect widespread showers or rain areas, in particularly inland areas and western ranges, but also we could be seeing some thunderstorm activity as well, where there is a chance we could see some moderate falls from persistent showers, rain or thunderstorms across many inland districts.
Right, okay. And that's when's that likely to start?
Look, it looks like the peak day of the rainfall is on the Tuesday, so anywhere west of the ranges is likely to receive some sort of rainfall. It's just a question as to where the focus of that widespread moderate rainfall could be.
So moderate rainfall, what are we talking in terms of millimetres?
So in terms of millimetres, currently the focus area is centred around the southern and central ranges, slopes, and then the adjacent inland plains. So we could be seeing around 20 to 30 millimetres or so. But obviously, from any shower or thunderstorm, this could be potentially higher, reaching into the 30 to 40 millimetres mark.
Okay, there's still a few, and there's a bit of a question mark as to how much and where, too. It could change around a bit between now and then.
Yes, yeah, so the current area of rainfall, it could change. It could potentially extend up a little bit further north towards the upper central west and even into the northwest slopes and plains as well, although it is quite less likely that we will see a bulk of the rainfall for the northwest slopes and plains.
So mostly Riverina, that sort of area?
Mostly the Riverina, the southwest slopes, the central tablelands, and also the central west slopes and plains.
Okay, Tristan, thanks for that.
No problem. Enjoy your afternoon.
You too. It's 21 minutes to one.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Australia's largest and oldest wool exporter, the South Australian-based Michelle Wool, has announced its intention to merge its direct buying and brokering operations with another exporting giant, the Victorian-based Endeavour Wool Exports. The company says that the partnership will open up more direct access for Australian wool growers to international markets. David Michelle is the chairman of what will be Michelle Endeavour Wool and explains what aspects of the two businesses are merging.
So Endeavour Wool has its own buying and broking business. They also have their own international trading business. So we haven't merged the international trading businesses because Michelle has international trading business as well, and we have our buying and our broking business as a supply source. So we have merged our supply activities, and we maintain our international trading focus.
Right, so the bits outside of the merge, they continue, as far as Michelle Wool is concerned, to operate as normal?
Yep, correct. So Endeavour's got their particular focus for international trade, and it's very very much on organising bespoke blends for their combing and spinning customers. And we have a particular focus on processing wool, carbonising and scouring here in Adelaide for our customers, and we make a bespoke product in a processed form.
So the aspects that you have then merged, what was the benefit that you saw of bringing these two aspects of the two businesses together?
Well, the whole broking activity is all based around scale. If it's not large enough, then you can't have enough people in the field and you can't cover the costs of their wages, etc. So two like-minded individuals, Josh Lamb and myself, we've been either working together and or working alongside each other on some of the peak body committees, looked at each other and worked out that we could do better by working together on the sourcing side than we could by being competitors.
And Endeavour's
about as simple as it gets.
Right, and Endeavour seemed like a good fit. Obviously, with two companies of very different sort of backgrounds. Obviously, Michelle's been around for quite a significant amount of time. Endeavour's a slightly newer, I guess, player in the game in a way.
Yeah, but I think the similarities are in the personalities. I think that's the key. Being around for 156 years, while it sounds fantastic, it's a bit of a legacy to maintain. So I'd rather be in Josh's position where you've got nothing to lose and let's go and see what we can make.
What does this, at the end of the day, mean for the growers that you deal with?
Well, see, Endeavour and Michelle bring a slightly different story and experience to the growers. The Endeavour guys are contacting with their customers overseas every day. And Michelle is contacting its customers every day. So we actually have live information. We have programs that we can bring to the market that don't actually hit any other particular supply stores. So we can actually bring live demand right from the user of the wool right down to the grower. Like we can talk about what happens next year. And in some cases, there could be well into the future, do you want to be a regular supplier to this customer? So it links the supply chain right down to the grower.
Now, is this merge all gone through? Is it still need sort of any sort of approvals or regulatory approvals to happen?
Yeah, look, don't talk to me about regulations because that's not where I live. But my team tells me it's an intended completion. As far as I'm concerned, it's alive and well, and all we're doing now is letting the lawyers do their thing. Apparently ACCC has to have a look at it as well. I just can't see why it's very useful, but apparently it is, so that's what we're doing.
Okay, so wool is no doubt more your thing, and this comes as obviously the wool industry is working its way back for some very, very tough years and some pretty poor pricing.
Yeah, look, wool's not on its own, by the way. I mean, every fibre around the world's had the same problem. It all stems from the COVID years where demand didn't actually bounce back after COVID and everyone's working hand to mouth. So wool, unfortunately, got caught up in a cycle of droughts and rains, and it gets pretty hard out there. I get that. But the world is actually very slow still. If you look at retail, they're not really bouncing around. So the price pressures are alive and well, but for the growers right now, because the clip has become smaller, demand for the rare supply is higher, which has pushed the prices up.
What are you seeing in terms of demand for wool at the moment, and where are you seeing it?
Right now, it's hard to tell because most of the Italians, for example, are at the beach. Middle of summer, heat wave, they're not interested in talking about wool at all. But to come around September, they'll all come back to work and they'll all be looking to see what they can do next. My guess is that wool, the natural story, the price is a bit of a hard one to swallow, but the natural story and the anti-plastics message is certainly getting through. So I would not like to see the market soften too much more. But then again, if it goes up by dollars, it might actually destabilise the demand that's a little bit fragile at the moment. So sideways would be a good point for everybody at this point in time, is my view.
Michelle Endeavour, Wool Chair David Michelle, speaking there to Selena Green about that merger between Michelle and Endeavour Wool in Victoria. It's coming up to a quarter to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. We're staying with in the wool space, sort of. Australia's sheep and lamb exporters are facing pressure from every direction, from disruption in the Suez Canal to Donald Trump's 12.5% tariffs. At home, tightening supply is pushing prices towards record highs, with lamb slaughter down 13% and mutton down a staggering 38%. Through all the ups and downs, Australia's biggest sheep and lamb exporter, Dubbo's Roger Fletcher, says he's trying to keep things as steady as possible. He told reporter Lucy Thackray he's absorbing some of the losses to protect both producers and consumers.
It's beyond our control. Australia doesn't even own one container ship, so we're at the mercy of the world where it is. And Suez Canal closed, the war in the Middle East, the Panama Canal closed, and then the ships can't go at the pace to save on oil and on their environment position. So that's had a huge effect on Australia, which is an isolated country.
You've just had containers turn up again. How long have they been out there?
Well, they've been there before the war. So they were shipped in early February, and it's your problem. No good going for help for anyone. We've just got to work it out. This is the beauty being a drover. When I was a driver, we had no phones or ink, and whatever went wrong, we had to work it out. That was probably the best education we could get, was you had a problem, you can't just pick up the phone and get some help.
How difficult has it been in terms of absorbing costs at a time when so much has been in flux, whether that be in the US with tariffs or with the meat that you're trying to export?
This is the problem. You only can take it off two ends, the customer or the farmer. You know, we are farmers ourselves, our family. We understand that, and, you know, we're trying to get productivity, but it's getting very, very difficult to get productivity up. And I'm real worried about Australia for that. To build anything, to get things through, the red tape, the holdbacks is going to destroy our manufacturing side. In the end, that destroys the farmer.
Trump's tariffs have come in 12.5% for sheep and goats.
The sheep industry in America, where more people are eating lamb than ever, because we've done the sophisticated of cutting it up and getting it into supermarkets, I think we're helping the American farmer by a long way. Unfortunately, with the coyotes and everything, their numbers have come down. It's changed, and we're probably the best country in the world to grow lambs.
What would it do to their market, to their trade, to be, you know, cutting off Australia when it's such a significant amount of their imports, around 80%?
I think we're a bigger benefit to the Americans than not. Their cottage industry, if you're killing the number they're killing a year, is very small. And that divests, guys. The population's changing in America. You've got a lot of lamb meat and imports that comes in, people, and they eat lamb different, where they want smaller lambs and big things, and their big lamb can only go in the supermarkets. We, no different in Australia. Our hardest product to sell is, say, lamb legs. They're too big. People want to buy just meals, and we're cutting them back to change all these products, what we're doing. And that's the meat industry is changing dramatically. And in America, there's no different in Australia. Go to the big supermarkets. They're smaller items. They want one meal, ready meal. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to go with the public, what we're reading, not what some scientist tells us, because we've failed on that so many times. Look at our customer. And, you know, we serve a supermarket or a restaurant. They are the last cab. The real customer is the one who buys the meat. And if they're not coming back, we've got a problem. Don't get muddled into things and tell you what you should be doing.
But domestically, the prices, do you see them holding? What do you see with lamb and sheep prices?
The issue is our lamb processing's been down dramatically. We try to keep our people together. We're all been losing money, which is you've got to do from time to time. That's, you know, it's no different to a farm in a drought. He loses money. You know, you've got to ride through them. It's where the market's going to be, but as more product comes on the market, these people are desperate to pull it back a little bit because they've got to sell it to more customers. How do you find more customers? By putting the price up. So virtually it will level itself out. Supply and demand, and it doesn't matter what we're in, from every fruit, vegetable, oil.
So do you see that over the next few months? What kind of...
I look at the long term of it all. I think, you know, the lamb market will come back some, but I think it'll be a very good sound what we're doing. And when we look at the lamb market, it's not what you're selling legs of lamb or racks of lamb. Here we spend all the money advertising racks, and they nearly all go out of Australia. So there's a huge difference.
Similarly, the price of mutton, is that a similar story?
We got down to where we were doing probably 10 or 20% of the mutton that we were killing. We still got to supply some customers. That's long term. We either got contracts with them, or most of mine, I've been dealing with this customer for 20 years. I can't afford to not look after him, no matter how much money I lose. Because is it better me to lose some money or lose my customer? And we've grown this business together for a long time. They got them on their menus and things. It's a balancing act.
Is it similar in that way with the demand and the need? You mentioned that kind of the US, how much those restaurants need Australian lamb and Australian meat.
This is the issue with us. If we can't supply, they can't put that menu out. And, you know, that's a challenge for all of us. And in the industry, it's done with, you know, a lot of the companies over there that probably got to buy off two or three people, because if they buy off one, if something goes wrong, they're dead, because they've promoted the product. And this is where they promote the product and the ships don't get there. I think inside our gate or inside our boundary, we can look after it. Outside of the boundary, we're getting red tape, shipping bad, transport bad. You know, you can't even... Here you've got the Great Western Highway and the road's closed. Come on. You go to Wellington, where we got our train goes over the bridge, it can only go at 15 kilometres an hour. It clogs up Wellington. Are we thinking forward as a country? And I think that's our biggest problem, is going out in front. Where should we be? I mean, take about some bad decisions.
Fletcher's International's Roger Fletcher, based in Dubbo.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Joining me for The World Today, with revelations that wealthy Christian sect The Brethren secretly paid far-right activists to perform stunts to disrupt the last federal election. Meanwhile, China is launching a mission to the moon to find ice. Court documents in the highly publicised battle for control of the Murdoch media empire have just been made public. And over in India, more than a million rickshaws in Delhi are to go electric. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
At 8 minutes to one, scones, lemon slice, how to cook yabbies. They're just some of the recipes you can find in the Dust Off and Dish Up cookbook, if you can get your hands onto it. The cookbook was released by the Broken Hills Parents and Citizens Association earlier this year in celebration of 70 years of remote education via School of the Air. It has since repeatedly sold out, that cookbook. Broken Hill Rural reporter M. Jensen spoke to co-editor and grazier Bessie Thomas to find out what makes this cookbook so popular.
This is the fifth cookbook that Broken Hill School of the Air have put out in their 70 years. They've generally been produced for every, 10-year anniversary, although there's 70 years and only five cookbooks. But the last one that they did 10 years ago, I was in the area and I have a copy of that cookbook. A lot of people do, because they sold, I think, about 7,000 copies over 3 years. It was called Boots Off, Aprons On. Yeah, it was a huge hit. And so as the 70, that was for the 60th anniversary. As the 70th anniversary approached, we knew what we wanted to do. And we knew that we wanted to do another cookbook that celebrated all the previous cookbooks, as well as all the current families, new recipes from the current families, current teachers, current students, and bring it all together into one super cookbook.
You could do any type of book. Why a cookbook?
Food is such a celebration of our community, where our families live. We are not close to the supermarket. We can't order takeaway for dinner. Food is a way that we connect with our families, connect with our staff on our properties, connect with our friends and our whole community. We're getting together for smoko in the paddock, or barbecues to celebrate birthdays, or, you know, nibbles on the veranda and drinks by the dam. Cooking is a passion and a necessity for those who it isn't a passion for, out where we live. It's something that brings everyone together. It's a lovely way to sort of grab little snippets from everyone's lives in a way that also then connects with a broader community, because food is really, it's essential, but it's also really precious to a lot of people.
Currently we're at the Broken Hill Bookshop, and you've brought a bag full of books to restock. How have sales been going?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I think Amanda told me at the bookshop told me yesterday she's sold 70, and yes, I've got another bag to give to her. But overall, we've sold about 4,500 copies since we launched in March. We now have about 12 shops that stock our book, not just in Broken Hill, but other country towns around New South Wales and Victoria. Hopefully get one in South Australia soon. We've sold them online to every state in Australia. You know, we also have families who are posting them overseas to friends and family overseas as well. So, yeah, we're really thrilled with how sales have gone, and we've raised so much money for the PNC Association. It's wonderful.
Where does the money raised from these books go?
It goes towards funding things that our PNC Association supports for the kids. So obviously a big part of our school that makes it a bit different to other schools is just the distance kids are to accessing things that they need to access. So for example, sport. Most children have the ability to go to weekend sport every weekend. Our students don't have that ability. So we run an after-school clinic like once a term when we're already in for classroom weeks, and PNC funds that. We've also funded things like art workshops and mental health workshops, and it also subsidises like our school camps, because travel to anywhere for our kids on the bus to go away to a school camp is so far, and we're trying to make sure that they have access to all of the things that their peers get access to.
Do you have a favourite recipe? Are any of your recipes in there?
Yeah, of course my recipes are in there. mine are great. I've got stuffed lamb rib flaps, and I've got a cocktail, a basil gin smash. I've got some dried figs that are great on a nibble splatter, and a really easy vanilla cake. But the ones that I've been making on rotation are other people's recipes, because of course I already know mine. At the moment, I'm completely obsessed with the Spring Hill lamb, which is the first recipe in the dinner section, which comes from Terry Griffiths, and it's like a slow cooked lamb, and the sauce that it's in is just melt in your mouth delicious. We had musterers out recently. I cooked that to make like slow cooked pulled lamb rolls with coleslaw. Oh, it was great.
That's Bessie Thomas, the co-editor of the new School of the Air cookbook, which is called the Dust Off and Dish Up cookbook. Not easy to get your hands on it, though. It's they've had 5 editions, I think she was saying, and they've repeatedly sold it out. She was speaking there about the success of the cookbook to our rural reporter, M. Jensen. It's 1:03. Let's go to markets now. Griffith Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 5,000. The quality continues to be good, with a lot of heavy and extra heavy lambs which have been grain fed. Trade weights were limited, and there was a small run of new season lambs, most of which were light to medium weight trades. The market was firm to $5 cheaper on average. New season trades 204 to 256 to average 1140. A heavy pen of new season Dorpers reached 309. The old trade weights 20 to 24 kilos 238 to 297. Most average between 1100 and 1150 cents. The 24 to 26 266 to 305 or 1100 cents on average. Heavy weights to 30 kilos 310 to 338. The extra heavies to 38 kilos 328 to 380, and those over 38 kilos reached a top of 420. Most range from 1,000 cents to 1,080. Heavy merinos reached 286 or 1090. Mutton numbers eased and prices were slightly dearer. Heavy crossbred ewes reached 320. Merinos in full wool 340, and most range from 800 to 850 cents.
And that's the market information for today. That was Graham Richard with the report there. It's coming up to 1:01.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Just reiterating some of the main stories on the program today. South Australia has reported 3 mass bird mortality events involving more than 1,000 crested terns presumed to have died from H5N1 bird flu. The deaths occurred at remote offshore islands, including Troubridge Island off York Peninsula and 2 small islands off Kangaroo Island. Another suspected case involves a little penguin from Kangaroo Island. And just reiterating that number to call if you do see any sick or dead birds or other wildlife as well. That's the other important point. If you see sick or dead birds or other sick wildlife, record what you see and then report it to the Emergency Animal Disease Hotline, which is 1-800-675-888, 1-800-675-888, in the wake of those thousands of birds that they have found, or 1,000 birds that they've found in South Australia. It's coming up to news time.